Members, we don't quite have a quorum at the current time, but we're going to get started. House File 1305, Slavik, Board of Cosmetology. And this is being laid over for possible inclusion. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bills on the agenda. So brevity will be appreciated as we try to get through these before session starts.
Okay. I'd like to make a motion that this bill 1305 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Well, thank you, Representative Slavik. Please proceed.
Okay. I was asked to carry this bill. I'm going to turn it over to Gina House and let her explain what it does. But one of the things that it does is it funds itself, so there's no cost to the state. And I thought that was important.
Representative Slavik, do you have a copy of the A1 amendment?
Oh, yes. I forgot about that. There is one amendment I'd move to have approved, the A1 amendment. And what that does, it deletes Section 11, which if we left it in, it would have to go to another committee and would not get passed in time.
Yeah, and what does that section do? Does that section eliminate the rulemaking exemption, I think it is?
Yeah, it eliminates the rulemaking exemption.
Okay.
Okay.
Which is always good to eliminate rule. I'm not a big fan of exempting rulemaking, so we'll take a look and see what that does.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Gina?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape, and we will proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. My name is Gina Stouse, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Cosmetology. This bill for the Board of Cosmetology has two purposes. First, the bill addresses housekeeping changes in statutory language that is either outdated, inconsistent, or silent. Secondly, this bill continues the board's application fee that is set to sunset on June 30th of 2013. This also creates inspection penalties and appropriates money to the Board of Cosmetology. With this bill, the board's contribution to the general fund will increase in the next fiscal years by $700,000, and of that, appropriating $300,000 back to the board. If you look at the bill, the one I have online, 1.4, we are looking at adding the trunk of the body to the scope of practice, which is a common waxing procedures are performed, and this will meet current standards, and there's no fiscal impact. On line 1.20, school manager, this is adding language to clarify ambiguity that an advanced licensee must still maintain their practitioner's license. And on line 2.1 for the instructor, it does the exact same thing, just clarifying to an instructor that they must maintain their practitioner license. The next section, which is section 4, this is what removes the sunset of the application fee. This application fee was set in place to help the board maintain a 15 business day licensing schedule, so we license all new applicants and renewals within 15 business days, and essentially this will never, at this point, not have a sunset date. On line 2.7, nail technician, this updates outdated terminology and changing manicurist to nail technician. And if I may, in the Senate, we noticed that manicure should actually be taken out, and they've done that in the Senate. There was an error there. If anybody else catches that.
Is that anywhere else in the bill other than right there?
On the very back page, there's the, on page 6, section 13, there is a revisor's instruction to change the term manicurist to nail technician throughout all.
I'll take care of it then.
Okay. Starting at line 2.29 and continuing for quite a few till 3.8, this creates penalties for various prohibited activities that will be defined later when I discuss them later. Discovered on an inspection, this will result in a reduction of illegal use of prohibited items. It will increase safety to the consumer as well as sanitation to the consumers and the licensees, and this will allow the board to focus its complaint and investigation work on the most serious violations, and this will result in increased revenue to the board. Would you like me to list, I'm trying to be timely upon your request, did you want me to go through those individually?
No, I think unless there's a question, you said you're going to address those a little later in the bill?
There's prohibited uses are defined, yes. Moving down to section 5, line 3.26, this is modifying the adding the school licenses to expire on the same day, the same cycle like salons do. It was just actually in 2009 it was forgot in the bill, so we're just cleaning that up. Subdivision or section 6, subdivision 4, we're clarifying ambiguity that the board makes the determination of who is an approved testing vendor. They would still have to go through an RFP process, but it just gives the board the authority to make that decision. Continuing on lines 4.5 and 4.6, again, it's doing the same thing. It's clarifying ambiguity that the board is the decision maker on who takes exams. Starting on line 4.11, this is allowing reciprocity applicants who have an active license in another state or country for at least 3 years, but less schooling hours set out in Minnesota rule, that they can apply for a license without additional schooling. And further, this is clarifying that transcripts the board receives in a foreign language be translated by a board-approved source. That starts on lines 4.1 to 4.20. Continuing on in section 8, line 4.29, it's eliminating the requirement to inspect prior to the opening of a salon. Most of the entire application is done on paper, and the city codes tend to sign off, and there's no public safety risk to inspect before a salon opens. Rather, it's once they're practicing where the safety and sanitation violations typically occur. Next, moving on to subsection 9, subdivision 11, instruction requirements. We're asking that schools be allowed to be open for 10 hours a day to accommodate part-time students, as well as allowing for partial online instruction for specific board-approved theory classes. This is, gets back section 10, the prohibited uses. There's kind of three sections of prohibited uses. And one is single-use equipment, things like a nail file, this so they're not used more than once. And if we find them being used more than once, that's where the penalties would come into play. The next one, Part B, starting on line 5.16, this would be razor-type callus shavers. If you think of like a grater, a cheese grater, these are prohibited uses. It's actually the practice of podiatry or medicine. And that, again, would be prohibited, as well as the next two are two different types of liquids used when applying fake nails. That is extremely harmful to not only the consumer, but the licensee practicing, and it's a typical OSHA. It's outlawed, and it's outlawed in many states. Section 11 is the one the amendment was just asked to take that out. Section 12 is this is allowing for the $300,000 base budget increase. Section 13 we discussed, which is just replacing the terms manicures to nail technicians. And lastly, there's the repealer is because in our fee, we have two sets of fees set out, one without the sunset and one with the sunset. And that is our bill. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Maybe, you know what I should do is I should have you describe what that on page 5, line 16, razor-type callus shavers, as
yes,
you explained. No, please don't. Many of us just got done with life.
I could bring one next time to demonstrate.
No, you don't. Members, we neglected to pass the A1 amendment. So, Representative Slavik, would you please... Oh, that's right. We have a quorum now, so now I can call us to order. The Jobs and Economic Development Committee is now in order, in session. Would you please move your bill and your amendment at this time?
Yes, I move my bill to be put in the omnibus bill bucket, and also that it be amended according to the amendment.
So, members. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you. Are there any questions on the Board of Cosmetology bill? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe some housekeeping issues for the author. How, or the testifier, how often does the board meet?
Mr. Chairman and members, the board meets anywhere from 5 to 6 times a year. Our schedule is generally set up for 5. This year we had to call a special meeting, and our complaint committee meets, which is an arm of the board. They meet 4 to 5 times a year, which is typical fashion with the health boards.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many complaints do you typically receive in a year?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, currently in our docket we have 250 complaints with 2 staff to investigate those complaints. We receive anywhere, I would say we're at 150 minimum a year. Those are the ones that rise to the level of an investigation. But I would imagine on our inspections, when we go do an inspection, we issue orders to comply, which would encompass part of what is in this bill. Not everything is in order to comply. In the metro area, 45% are issued orders to comply, 40 to 45%. Outstate, it's a little less. They're a little more compliant outstate.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
What would be the typical nature of a complaint or an infringement upon current regulation?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the typical ones of a complaint would be practicing without a license, either you've never been licensed or that you've let your license expire for generally over 1 year. We've had people practice 10 years without a license, and that would be one part. Another arm is our safety and sanitation, not cleaning like your pedicure tubs, finding excessive, hair in different areas. Our complaints are kind of twofold, safety and sanitation and licensing.
Just one final, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And then that goes to the improper disposal. If you could just elaborate in terms of what would be proper disposal. I mean, could you just elaborate, because I don't visit these.
Yes,
established.
Absolutely.
You don't inspect.
I just
these.
Have a bowl and a shears.
Yes, absolutely. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, when you go to a nail salon, like typically it's a nail salon, and they're using just your good old nail file that's porous, and they use it on me, and it can absorb any fluids from my feet, from my nails, whatever, and then they just go and use it on the representative next. That would be a good example, a nail file, or when they take your cuticles and they use a wood thing to push them back. Well, if they use one on me and one on you and it's wood, it can transmit MRSA, it can transmit any type of infections, where salons are tending to go more towards metal nail files because those are sanitizable. So the items in here, the single use, are those type of a sponge where they clean your heels to remove calluses. Well, those sponges absorb any sort of...
Are we at the level that you more than you
yes.
want to
Yes. Are we good?
Madam, Mr. Chair, just confirms why I don't visit those establishments. Do my own pedicure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I can testify to that, because the last time I had a manicure, I got an infection in my nails, and I'm having a hard time clearing it up.
Representative Fabian, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dallas, on page 2 and 3 of the bill, you've got a wide variety of new penalties and so forth for a number of different activities. Can you tell me, under current law, what do you do if you found that you have some of these situations that are occurring?
Mr. Chairman and members, well, generally with most of these, they would, or with some of these, they would rise to the level of moving to an investigation, because we have to get someone who's not licensed, and if they don't do it on their own, we need to start the complaint process, which our docket, as I mentioned, is at 250, and we're trying to resolve some of these quickly. Now, when you get to, like, number 8, when we go back to the razors, we will write them on their inspection that they're using a prohibited item. Number On like number 9, we would, where they're performing incorrect services, they would get cited for performing unlicensed services, and we would ask them to become licensed in their correct services. The only ones that, let's see here, essentially all the violations are violations right now. It's just we're assessing a penalty for the ones listed.
And we are going to be voting on, we're going to move on in about 2 minutes. So you got a couple minutes to ask your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up, so there's no provisions in here for warnings? I mean, on a first offense, if somebody's doing something that, can be construed as being somewhat accidental or something, mm-hmm. we don't do warnings? Are we just going straight to the fines?
Mr. Chairman, members, well, when you assess a fine, they have a right to appeal and go through that process. But these are the most, out of our complaints and out of our inspections, these we find are the most egregious and the ones that we feel need immediate resolution. The ones that, like, if, let's say, their towels aren't in a closed cabinet, we will cite them for towels, but they're not, that doesn't rise to the level of a fine. And these are, I don't want to say they're on the spot, because the inspectors are not out there collecting money. They're going to issue an invoice, and we send that via email. So there is no warning, though, to answer your question for the ones listed in here.
Quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 3, line 3.8, it says refusal or failure to cooperate with an inspection, possibility of appeal there, and who determines the failure to cooperate?
Mr. Chairman and members, this doesn't happen often, but I can tell you when they do happen, the administrative office is immediately contacted, and we are generally in contact with the salon immediately. If an inspector walks in and the owner or manager that's responsible says to them, you cannot come in or you cannot start, we don't continue, because you have to worry about people's physical safety, and that's our primary concern, as well as worrying about employees' physical safety. That would then rise to the level of, you know, failure to cooperate. It might be that they're just having a bad day and we need to go back. When this happens, I can tell you that the office is immediately notified.
Thank you.
Yep.
Members, the motion is to lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Slavik. Next up is Representative Metza, House File 504. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And this goes to the General Register, and I'm looking at the fiscal note, and there is no fiscal implication to the state. Am I correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Would you like to make your motion? I think it is to the General Register.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that House File 504 be passed and move to the General Register.
And you have a witness, and that I know can explain it, because he's explained it to me in less than 10 minutes, but what this bill does.
We'll shoot for 2 or 3 minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Would you like to explain your bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically, House File 504 changes the way Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association, or WCRA, charges premiums to its members, insurers, self-insurers, to make sure that those premiums are adequate to cover all the benefits the WCRA expects to pay for seriously injured workers. I'm going to cut it kind of short there, because I think a lot of questions may get asked, and some of my description may have that work out with Buzz here, who is the genius behind this thing. So,
Cummins, would you like to explain this particular bill?
I had one thing to add, though. It is the first bill, Mr. Chair and members, that I've seen that the AFL-CIO and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce have both endorsed. So,
it's the only bill to come out of the Workers' Comp Commission. Just wait till next year when I bring forth the bill that gets rid of the Workers' Comp Advisory Board. Right ahead, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Buzz Cummins. I'm president of the Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association. Briefly, by way of introduction, the WCRA was formed in 1979 by the legislature. We are not, however, a state agency. We have our own board of directors, and we're regulated by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. Our purpose is to provide reinsurance for workers' compensation to all of the insurers and self-insurers in the Minnesota workers' compensation system. We have more than 600 such members, so it's a substantial organization. Those members purchase reinsurance from us at one of three retention limits or deductibles. When the legislature created us, they wanted to keep the costs of reinsurance down, so they put a cap on, called a pre-funded limit in the statute, on what claims we could actually charge for, so that we are allowed to charge a regular premium, if you will, for claims between the member's retention limit and that statutory pre-funded cap. Any benefits that would get paid out above that cap are totaled up every year and then spread across our members annually. This year we will collect about $49 million in regular premium and $3.6 million in unfunded premium, or for cost above that pre-funded cap. That structure worked very nicely for us for the first 24 years because we didn't have any claims that exceeded the pre-funded limit. But largely because of rapidly rising medical costs, we've had more and more claims that have exceeded the limit. We now, as I said, are paying about $3.6 million this year. But we expect that those claims will increase in volume and amount rather dramatically, so that over the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, those claims will rise to about $30 to $35 million per year. So that is the problem that our members are concerned about. And the solution to that problem of rapidly rising claims is the bill before you, House File 504, which is to eliminate the pre-funded limit. The cost of that that change will be about a 2 to 3% increase in the premium that we charge to our members annually, but it will have very, very substantial benefits to them in the long run. Let me just quickly enumerate them. Number one, it makes us operate more like a real insurance company. We will charge enough premium to pay all of the claims that we expect to have to pay. It will prevent those dramatic long-term increases in unfunded premium. There will be very significant premium savings to our members to the tune of perhaps $300 million or more over the next 20 or 30 years. So that's very substantial, and our members like that very much. It ensures that there will be funds available to pay the claims for seriously injured workers in the future, and it is more equitable because everybody will be paying today for the claims that they expect to incur in their accounts as insurers or self-insurers. Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any significant opposition to the bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Cummins. Are there any questions for the testifier or the author? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one for the testifier, and you talked about your members. What kind of communications have you done with them leading up to this bill coming to this so that they know that this is coming? And
we started about 2 years ago to poll our members and educate them about this process. We have the endorsement of the Minnesota Self-Insurers Association and the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, which represent the two groups of members that we have in our association. We have conducted small group discussions. We have put it in our newsletters. We've worked through the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to make him aware of it, and he supports it. So it's been a long process.
Are there any other questions for the testifier? And this one is going to the General Register. So would you like, seeing none, is there anyone that would like to testify against this bill? Seeing none. Representative Metz, would you care to renew your motion?
So moved.
I'll repeat it. House file. Your motion is the House File 504 be passed and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You're on the way to the register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, we got
Ike, did you see your graph?
My graph?
Victory season.
They put it together for
me. Just you?
What graph? This thing?
Be brief.
Yes, sir. No, I didn't have a graph. Yeah, you're
fine. Oh, yeah.
All right. Yeah, get it.
Somebody's got to be a smart ass.
Rep. Jim Mahoney, would you like to move your bill?
I'd like to move House File 991 for to lay over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. I have House File 991 allows for the development agencies such as the Port Authority and some others, and there is an amendment to apply for Minnesota Investment Fund grants, and there's no loans involved in this. It's all grants from the NIF, right? Yeah. And I have an amendment in there that will allow a county agencies to actually do this also. So
this is the A1 amendment.
It is the A1 amendment.
Yes. Like to, I'll move the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mahoney.
What the A1 amendment does, looking for my helpline, Dakota County Community Development Agency, they have a little different structure than many other places. And what the law says in this bill, it does not define as the Dakota, the county community development agencies. It defines all sorts of other ones. Section 116J552. What this does, well, I'm going to call up Kathy Honey, because frankly, this is, it's been explained to me a couple of times. I'll probably screw it up if it's not explained four or five times to me.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kathy Honey. I'm a lawyer at Fagry Baker Daniels, and I'm here representing the Dakota County Community Development Agency. I'll maybe just backtrack 1 minute and speak to the bill, because as Representative Mahoney said, what the bill allows is some additional applicants to the Minnesota Investment Fund, economic development authorities, port authorities, and housing and redevelopment authorities. The Dakota County Community Development Agency is a little bit of a hybrid. We call them CDAs. We have three or maybe four CDAs in the state. They're county entities. Like all the other entities we've named, they are political subdivisions. They have taxing authority, all of them, EDAs, HRAs, port authorities, and a CDA. But a CDA by legislative authority is a blend of HRA powers, Housing and Redevelopment Authority powers, and EDA powers. So they're kind of a unique entity. And the Dakota County CDA was created by a special law quite a few years ago. So it appeared to us less complicated from what Deed was willing to be okay with, and what the other organizations behind House File 991, it appeared to us to be a little less complicated to put the CDA language into their special law, both for them and for the other parties of value. So what the amendment does is for only the Dakota County CDA, this one entity, it would allow, should the county, Dakota County itself, desire to transfer their authority to apply to the Minnesota Investment Fund to the CDA. And in Dakota County specifically, it's the CDA that's the economic development entity in the county. The Dakota County itself does all kinds of other work, as you all know. The CDA is really their housing economic development entity that does those kinds of projects. So the bill says that if the county transfers their power to the CDA to be an applicant to the Minnesota Investment Fund, and if the County Board of Commissioners is the same entity that oversees the CDA, so they've got the same board, just like a lot of HRAs, city HRAs have city council as their HRA board, and there's the same board. So the same thing is true in Dakota County. The Dakota County Board of Commissioners is the board for the CDA. So if both of those conditions are in place, then the CDA can be the eligible applicant for the funds. And I know it's a little complicated. I'm happy to answer questions.
And you wondered why I called her up here.
Discussion on amendment. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I understand it. Are the same account of same accountability measures still in the are they maintained in the transfer to the ADA? In other words, the requirements that are in the bill now, in the law now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark. Yes, there is a notwithstanding there, and the notwithstanding refers to sort of the city sign-off language. Because we're dealing with a county entity, and under current law, you don't need city sign-off when a county does a project. You don't need that. The city sign-off isn't exactly appropriate. And what Deed doesn't want to have happen to him, quite frankly, and I don't blame him in the least because I used to do this stuff there, they don't want to get in the middle of some sort of conversation or disagreement, if you will, between a county and a CDA or a city and a port authority. So what we wanted to make sure, again, is that you've got the same decision makers. So we don't change anything else in the program as it's currently structured, with the exception of that new language, its applicability. Does that
I think so, Mr. Chair. Clark. I'm trying to look at the amendment here, and I'm not sure if that's to this bill, right? No, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's a different bill. Okay, it's a different one. Okay, but so the main thing I'm just concerned about is that we keep the same criteria there for keeping track of the jobs, the goals for jobs and wages and all that. It's still in there. Okay. I see a head shaking yes, so that's...
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, that's correct.
Thank you.
Doesn't change any of that.
Thank you.
Very good.
No, I will renew my motion to incorporate the A1 amendment to 991.
All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
So, members.
To the bill.
To the bill. She almost explained the whole bill. and I will briefly, what this does is this allows more people to apply for the Minnesota Investment Fund monies with a little, that's basically what we're trying to do. As cities and port authorities and CCDAs are now eligible to go to the state and do this. And we checked with Deed, and they're comfortable with this particular language. Having said that, a little presentation from the Port Authority, briefly.
Identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Lori Lauder. I'm the Director of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority. I'm also speaking as the co-chair of the Legislative Committee of EDAM, the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, who supports this change. Mr. Chair, I'll just make a few quick comments here. The Port Authority's mission, in brief, is to assist with business growth, the creation of quality jobs, retention of quality jobs, and to expand the tax base. And we do this by leveraging both public and private dollars on each transaction. Our economic development activities at the St. Paul Port Authority, Mr. Chair, fit very nicely into the statutory purposes of MIF. And so, very briefly, the purpose of this amendment is to streamline the process. As you can imagine, be it the Port Authority in St. Paul or an EDA somewhere, if they have a business relationship, an established business relationship with a customer, and they are working on all the details, the economic development details of a certain proposed transaction, it makes sense for the structuring of the entire transaction, including, in some cases, the MIF program funds. It makes sense to do that and to keep that customer control, as you will. It's called lead account manager system, as I'm sure you all know. And so since we have the lead role in working particularly in the industrial sector with growing customers, we thought this would make sense. In closing, Mr. Chair, we believe this change is a modest change, but it does big things. It promotes efficiency of activity, so that we can structure these transactions directly with our customer. And then once that's ready to go, we apply directly to Deed, And, of course, along the way there, we would certainly check in with the city officials and seek approval on a case-by-case basis. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lauder, for further questions about the bill. Representative Albright.
Just a question for either testifier, and maybe this was already explained, but can these CCDA, thank you, organizations spend the MIF dollars, or are the MIF dollars applied for and administered on the local level by the local unit of government?
Representative Mahoney.
I'm gonna clarify something here, and then I will get the answer from Ms. Lauder. The county community development agencies will be considered the same as the Port Authority or Housing Authority or any of the others. With this amendment, they now are in the same boat and are covered by the same same laws and laws or regulations as it's kind of gone through on page two. So yes, they should be able, and then they can spend it. Your answer.
Ms. Lauder.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney is right. You will see in your language the proposed tweak is that development authorities are mentioned, and that is the umbrella name, if you will, the umbrella group name for port authorities, EDAs, community development authorities, and so forth. So once they do their work, to your question, Representative, on the second part of your question, then the locality must approve that before the funds are spent and before deed would disperse the funds for to any of these authorities.
Representative Albright.
So to ask a rhetorical question, then, this simplifies the process.
Madam, Mr. Chair, excuse me, and Representative, absolutely. That's the purpose of this request.
Representative Uglum.
Where's Representative Fabian when I, you know, what?
That's right. thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a great bill. I think the counties and the EDAs and the cities and everyone are going to appreciate this greatly. It does streamline things. In some cases, they've been cut out in the past a little bit. So I think that this is a real good example of being able to promote development for many, many different government entities. So I think it's long overdue, and it will be very beneficial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair, unless there's any other questions testifiers against?
I would just ask if there are any folks in the audience wishing to testify for or against the bill. Seeing none.
I'd renew my motion to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You can keep that one. I've got it. Thank you, Mary. Members, I think my next bill on the docket is 1131, which is a bonding request. It is the University Enterprise Labs request. With me today, I have Jeremy Lenz, who is the new board chair, and
Tom LaSalle.
Members, the UEL laboratories are located just on the west side of 280, between 280 and the university campus. It is I can't even remember the total square foot now, but it is an incubator. It has been in place for about 5-6 years now. I don't know if I carried this bill or not the first time, but you know, when you're here long enough, you start to see the same bills coming back. This is for an expansion. This is for an expansion of that particular facility because it is 100% full and has been for some time. And we want more places for small tech startups to grow. And with that, I will let the presentation from the UEL.
If I may, Representative Mahoney, did you move the bill on is this to re-refer to capital investment?
And just in the event that I did not, members, I'd like to move House File 1131 for passage and re-refer to the Committee on Capital Investment.
Very good. Thank you. And identify yourself for the record, please.
Wonderful.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, members, thank you for the opportunity today. My name is Jeremy Lenz. I'm the chair of the University Enterprise Laboratories Board of Directors. With me today is Tom LaSalle, who is with Tapestry Management, which is our management real estate management facility, and also is our real estate expert on our financing. We are going to go over this very quickly at the request of Representative Mahoney. And one thing I want to say is I'm extremely honored to be sitting here today because one of the last projects that I worked on when I was a project manager at the City of St. Paul back in 2004 was with this newly minted representative named Tim Mahoney from the east side of St. Paul. And I had the honor of being a project manager on this facility when it was still a warehouse for Target Direct. I still have my hair after working with Representative Mahoney for that long. Today, what we represent is a 125,000 square foot facility that has 285 employees, 30 companies as a bioscience incubator, which if you think about the economy over the last 8 years is really saying something. This was a very difficult time economically to house an incubator, which is intended to be aggressive in terms of how we are supporting the companies, the high-risk companies that are represented in the facility. A bioscience incubator, for those that haven't had a chance to get a briefing on this yet, a bioscience incubator really is what's required for regions to be competitive for these very high-paying jobs. As you'll see in the briefing sheets, these jobs pay on average $85,000 plus, and they have a very high multiplier into the local economies. So in many ways, what you see here with UEL's facility is something that's required for us as a region to be able to be nationally competitive. And the fact that we are open today is no small feat, and give a lot of credit to the thought leaders that participated in this before to keep the facility open. Incubating companies is very hard work. And when you look at the documents that are in front of you, what we really wanted to tell you is a story about how wet lab space is something that you don't want startup companies to be managing. You want to do that almost as a collective. So that we have experts like Tom and his company that are able to do that on behalf of the company so that as they grow, they don't have to worry about building another very expensive wet lab facility. They can focus on the science, they can focus on their technology, they can focus on improving lives and saving lives. So the 30 companies that we have there today, as Representative Mahoney mentioned, we've been 100% leased since 2010, and we have been 90% leased since 2008. And it's I know I'm getting some smiles from a couple of you that have been participating in this for a very long time. Those are really, really exciting numbers when you think about what we've been through as a state and as a country. And just a couple of other key points. When you look at the reason why we have the companies in that space together, what we're able to do, especially as a cash-positive nonprofit, we have shared equipment, $200,000 of shared equipment that they don't have to manage. Tom and his team take care of that for them. So we actually vote as the companies, we vote in terms of what that new equipment is so that they can get shared equipment that they don't have to spend $100,000 on a new piece of equipment that they only use for a couple hours a month. So you can get a feel of what the community is like in this space. The other thing that we really want to focus on in terms of today's request is in one way, you can think of this as an expansion, but really what this is a completion. The fifth page that you have in your packet really talks about completing UEL Phase 2. So what we really think of this as is a $38.1 million facility at about 160,000 square feet that will have 48 wet labs. Today, we have 24 wet labs, and again, those have been leased up for the last 3 years, 100%. You would think that this could become a for-profit concern. Other for-profits would, if we're throwing off tenants that are not able to, that we aren't able to house, you would think that another development would come along and see a business opportunity. It's not working that way. This is what public investments, this is a good use of public investments. And what we really want to demonstrate to you is last dollars in. And we invite the legislature and the bonding committee to join us in terms of the $24 million that's already been raised, and to join us with a $14.1 million request to finish off the project, which this will be a fully completed project at 160,000 square feet, $38 million. With that, I appreciate your time. Any questions for Tom or for myself?
Thank you, Mr. Lenz. Was Mr. LaSalle going to testify or just
Mr.
request?
LaSalle's
Okay. Any questions?
Just here to answer questions.
From members.
Yeah. Representative Dunn. Thank you. I think the success is wonderful, too. But I was just curious, because I come from greater Minnesota.
Yes, sir.
Is it possible to replicate something like this in the Mankato? And I'm sure that we would bust our hump to get it funded, wouldn't we, Representative Mahoney?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, you don't have far to go down the road to see what replicated down in Worthington. Theirs is considerably smaller. I think it's 15 to 25,000 square foot pole barn with a lot more, you know, decent equipment in it, and I think they're actually back in front of the bonding committee looking for $300,000. And I think you also know that about 4 or 5 years ago, I put a bill in that would put six of these similar ones to Worthington around the state. And you know, your children look at you and, you know, laugh when you pretend that you're young. That's kind of the reaction I got up here when I wanted to do six more of them, because I thought it would be a good way to do it. And this is an example of a success. The Worthington example is another example of success. And one thing that I will say to UEO and Worthington's credit is they've not come back for operating funds. These places around the country typically come back to the state for anywhere from $3 to $4 or $6 million a year in operating funds, and no one's done that here. This is, I would hope that you would support this. It's a good idea.
Fine.
Other question, Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a comment. I just wanted to applaud Representative Mahoney and the crew here testifying for their hard work on this. I think, you know, as a younger person joining the legislature, that the more we can invest in technological opportunities, and especially knowing that he's trying to get some out in greater Minnesota, is extra nice. But I just think it's so important for us to do that, and wanted to thank you for that.
Any other questions? Representative Buglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Metz, didn't you notice the fine print? It says the range is excluded on this.
No, don't tell him that.
I'm just kidding. Representative Uglum, I appreciate it, but our kids are all going to go there.
All right. So I'm just kidding. Chair,
Representative Uglum.
Representative, I think this is a wonderful bill. This is exactly what we're all talking about, generating jobs, high-paying jobs in the state of Minnesota. You always have to invest a little money to make a little money, and this is probably a perfect example. And the idea about not coming back to us for operating funds, I think that's just absolutely great that you guys are doing that on your own. Thank you.
Well, you can look at it this way. They've been in business, what, 6 years, $3 million a throw? We've already covered that $14 million.
Yes,
I will renew my motion to... I guess you're supposed to ask if anybody wants to testify again.
I just had a comment, Representative Mahoney, and I think we need to be careful that none of this getting along stuff gets out to the press. You know, they're going to fall off their chairs. So, Representative Isaacson.
I think it is a little rampant. We got along in our last committee as well, and had several bipartisan votes. I was not quite sure what to do, and I'm a little confused.
I think we're all sleepy or something. Representative Mahoney.
I would renew my motion that I got to get the bill number out. 1131 be passed and referred to the Committee on Capital Investment.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
Thank you, members. Mr. Chair, thank you.
I think we have.
Thank you.
Oh, is that it?
Have one more bill, and then I'm done.
Okay. 1199.
1199.
Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would move House File 1199 be passed and re-referred to taxes, to the Committee on Taxes. What House File 1199 does is it deals with the angel investment tax credit. Now, I think we have about a dozen angel investment tax credits in the committee, all of them calling for money. This is the only one that does not. This is the and I'm going to call down the Department of Employment and Economic Development to verify what I'm saying, but this is the small number of changes that makes management of the program simpler and easier, but does not include any money, and it's just cleanup to problems that we've had in the past. If you would like to go to page 2, line 10, liquidation event means the conversion of the, exactly as it says, conversion of a qualified investment for cash or other considerations. And what we're trying to do is keep investors invested in it and not let them get out earlier than they're supposed to. That's kind of the angel investment principle, is to keep the investor in as long as possible. We are making an expansion, an exemption, and I probably should let Mr. Nelson, the testifier, explain 3.25. 3.34 just says that the business has not issued securities that are traded on a public exchange. That was not in the other one. 4.45, again, the business must not have issued its securities. And it's just trying, 4.6 and 7, business must not issue securities that are traded in public exchange within 180 days after the date of the qualified investment is made. So we're just trying to keep members, investors invested in the company, sharing their knowledge with the company and with the entrepreneur. And then there is a piece in here where they are able to disseminate the mailing address, the phone number, the email address, and contact person of the company, the angel investment company that's been qualified. That's what the bill does, and I will ask Mr. Nelson to explain the change to the 20 years on page 3, line 25.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Nelson. I run the Angel Tax Credit Program for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Representative Mahoney's bill has three components. The component that he was just referring to is changing a current requirement. There's currently a requirement that businesses that participate in the program cannot have been in operation for more than 10 years. Those businesses, however, that need to get FDA approval for whatever they're doing, such as creating a medical device, creating a new pharmaceutical, those businesses, it takes them far longer to get through the process. So what this change allows is that those businesses can be in operation for more than less than 20 years in order to participate in the program. The other two changes that Representative Mahoney is moving forward with this bill here, one is I sort of generally categorize as the anti-gaming provisions of the bill. We've had a few instances. Well, let me explain. When an investor makes an investment in one of the businesses pursuant to the program, we require that that investor hold that investment for 3 years. If they do not hold it for 3 years, they have to pay back the tax credit. However, there are a few exceptions. One of those exceptions being that if the company were to go public, then they wouldn't have to repay the credit. We've had a couple of instances where investors made an investment, received the credit, but within just a few months, and most likely to the knowledge of the investor, the company went public, and therefore the investor is really getting a windfall. They're getting both the gain from that investment and the credit. These changes that Representative Mahoney is proposing would help eliminate that. The other change that Representative Mahoney mentioned was a change to some of the data that we collect about businesses. Right now, the only data that we can release about a business is the name of the business, so we put that on our website pursuant to the legislation. We've had a lot of requests from both the businesses and investors that in addition to just the name of the business, that we provide some very basic contact information. The name of the business, the address, a contact person, a phone number, an email. No more than what you would find in a very basic SEC filing that these businesses have to do anyway. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Question, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two questions, the first of which goes to the 180-day provision that you spoke about going pre-IPO. And I'm just wondering if that conforms or is in conflict with the red herring requirements under the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission rulings?
He knew he was here for a reason.
Mr. Nelson.
Representative I'm sorry, I do not have the answer to that. We can research that and come back with an answer for you.
Thank you. A follow-up, sir.
Representative Albright.
And then with regard to the three-year holding period, I just wonder whether or not that's a conflict with Section 144 of the SEC code as well.
Okay. Mr. Nelson.
I will, Representative, I will double-check on that, but I do not believe it is. When we created the program, we did work with the Department of Commerce, with the securities folks there, to make sure that all the provisions of the bill were in accordance with federal law also. Mm-hmm. But we'll double-check on that.
Finalize those two. I find great comfort in that. Thank you.
Mr. Nelson will provide that information, and Representative Albright. Thank you. Further questions on 1199? Anybody in the audience wanting to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none. Representative Mahoney.
I would renew my motion that House File 1199 pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I believe we are recessed here. We're in recess till a little bit after session here, 3:15, 15 minutes after floor session.
Talk very briefly about the program,
a statewide paid internship program that connects college students in STEM majors to hands-on opportunities in small Minnesota companies. The companies receive a dollar-for-dollar matching stipend from the SciTech Experience program to help cover 50% of the intern's wages. The match is capped at $2,500. Candidates apply online and are screened to make sure that they meet program criteria. The full criteria are listed on the handout, and I'm just going to highlight a couple of them. I guess the two biggest ones for companies is that they need to have fewer than 100 employees and offer a hands-on experience in a STEM position. And a couple of the industries that are included are aerospace, defense, and energy, biotech and life science, IT, and manufacturing. And the criteria for students are that they must be from Minnesota or going to school in Minnesota and have a GPA of 2.5 or greater and be halfway through their STEM degree. STEM degrees would include things like biology, chemistry, physics, engineering, computer science, things like that. As I mentioned, this is a statewide program. I've included a map. It's the second page of the packet, and this shows the hometowns of the students that have applied to the program since January of 2012, so you can really see that it really is a broad program in that way. We've also included five letters of but one of our students has joined us today, as you'll meet him shortly. We've also included five letters of support that are in the packet and an article from the St. Cloud Times about the program for you to look at later, give some great additional insight. As you know, there's a lot of focus on the importance of STEM education in the K-12 programs, getting kids into science and getting them into college in those degrees. And SciTech Experience is that next step that helps them bridge the gap between the classroom to career and preparing and building Minnesota's much-needed STEM workforce. Thank you.
Thank you. I am actually looking forward to hearing you. Please proceed. Because I did visit with a number of students at their internship. Fabian, do you want a croissant?
I want a bill, but I heard that
you don't have the bill?
Nobody does.
Classroom tasks to achieve an A differed greatly from my work
chose school as my... Sorry?
Higher wages.
Yes, promotion. I chose to remain at school at the U of M, but I have retained the connections with my senior researchers and kept the door open for future opportunities with Centurion. My interest in pursuing further opportunities in the scientific field in general was greatly stimulated through the Scientech Experience Program, and I look forward to remaining in Minnesota and expanding my horizons in truly meaningful research that this experience provided for me.
I have visited a number, a variety of interns in a variety of companies around the state, actually around the metro region, and I will applaud these interns, one brighter than the next, and engaging and funny and really dedicated to what they are trying to learn. So, having said all that, are there any questions for the witnesses? Yes, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the, you call that croissant?
Sugar rush. I might not have had to give you one, though.
We don't have fancy food like that in Roseville. So I appreciate the diversity in my appetite or my nutrition. I'm sorry, Eric, is it?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you, Eric. I'm curious to know, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want, but I heard earlier testimony they said in the applications that they required a GPA of 2.5. Was that correct in that?
I think that's correct, yes.
Did you have a higher than 2.5 grade point average when you applied for this?
I did.
Okay, I assume that. Thank you. My question would be for the other testifiers, the 2.5, the threshold, is that...
We'd like to answer that. I mean, what
2.5 is what I had in college. I mean, that's kind of low.
So I guess you would have qualified for this if you'd wanted to.
I could have qualified for a lot of things. I'm just curious to know why that's the threshold that you've chosen.
Well, Mr. Chair...
I realize it's a list of a lot of other things.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 2.5 was meant to broaden the applicant pool because in a number of these... in these cases, especially for certain elements of the high-tech area, the STEM education area, there are a number of students who are very skilled at certain areas, such as computer programming, for example, or something like that, who might not have, you know, a broadly high GPA. And so the purpose was not to shut off the program too high so that we could keep that open for people who had real skills. I mean, the point of the program is to filter out people who are not qualified. So we, all of our interns that we put forward, that we believe are qualified to work, and then ultimately the business makes the decision whether or not to hire them after interviews.
Can I address Mr. Fabian?
My students call me that
once. As I was looking through the material that they said ahead of time, one of the grades of the program got feedback from businesses was the high quality, because they appreciate the screening tool as well as the high quality.
Minnesota for years to come. Mr. Chair?
Team Kelly learning already.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Representative, we will provide information that we have on those stats to you, and we do track numbers of those who are employed. This is only, we're only in the second year that we're just starting now, and so we share those goals with you exactly the same, and we'll be tracking those, and we'll be very happy to share those with you.
Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, a comment on Representative Kiefer's point, and I wish we would do that with a lot of our programs, subsidizing a lot of the kids coming through school, and a lot, and we have a lot of them, but really, we do want them to stay here. That should be a provision that, that should be put in. Thank you for backing in and watching that, and hopefully we do get data. I have two questions, quick, simple. Number one, credits. Do we, is this, are these college credits that they get in the program? That's number one. And number two, we funded this last question is about the historical funding last biennium, so that's the second.
Good question.
Representative Norton, you might know.
Please have to respond there, Mr. Tolson.
Yes, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the second question, this was a competitive grant out of the Department of Economic Development for $150,000 for the first year, and we were able to fund a sort of a startup pilot program of interns. Then during the second year of the biennium, there was only $30,000 available, and we did some private fundraising to bring in some more interns. But really what we're doing, trying to do, we believe this program is so effective in the way that it matches interns with either the same company or quite often different companies, but because they have that experience, they're able to get full-time employment far before others without it. And so that's why we're trying to scale it up, and we hope to grow it in the coming years as well. And I'm sorry, credits.
There were 246 applicants in the first round, and they
could
place 67.
Mr. Chair, the credit requirement is that they have to be halfway through their degree. So if it's a two-year program, they have to be in there the summer between. So if it's 60 credits, they have to have finished 30. And if it's 120 credits, they have to have finished 60, but they do not earn credits for the program unless it's through a separate arrangement with their university.
Any other questions?
So,
Representative Pavian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the map, this is Pavian on Mr. Tolleson, I presume. Looking at the map and with the Hope Collins student applicants, do you have the same information or similar with regards to which colleges the students are going to?
Mr. Representative, we absolutely do, and I didn't bring those with us today, but I'd be very happy to send those to you.
And then one other question, if I may, Mr. Chair, can we get a list of the businesses that have accepted these interns?
Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. We'll provide that to you as well.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Norton. Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had more of a comment and wanted to applaud our students here who are taking advantage of this. As a young person myself, hopefully youngest legislator in the room at least, I think it's really great that we're making these investments. I was actually very interested. One of my good friends was the former VP and chief legal counsel at Medtronic, and he was from the Iron Range, and I think, you know, providing these kind of opportunities get a better shape than their parents is the whole reason we're here doing this work on a day-to-day basis. So I just want to say thank you for taking advantage of the program. I'm hoping it will be a continued success.
Very good. Any other questions on the bill? If not, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion, House File 1053. Thank you, Representative Norton and testifiers. Thank you very much.
Sure.
And the next one we're bringing up here is House File 626, Representative Blesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members.
let other individuals here testify as to the nuts and bolts of it, but I can tell you, most people around this table who've served with me before know that I rarely give a speech on the House floor without including some movie quote. And it's because I love movies. And Minnesota has a pretty decent history with respect to our film and television, but we could do better. And of the 41 states that offer some kind of incentive in the United States, we're the least competitive. We need to do better because the industry is changing to the point where technology allows you to do this anywhere. It's not just in L.A. anymore. And because of that, we need to be on the cutting edge of this. It's not just for economic development for our state. It's a matter of state pride, especially with the movies that are made here. Many of us, and I'm sure the people who testify can tell you which ones they are. But I'd ask the committee's strong consideration of this, and with this I'd hand it over to my testifier.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good evening. My name is Lucinda Winter, and I'm the executive director at Minnesota Film and TV. We have functioned since 1983 as the state's film commission. Every state, just about every state in the United States has a film commission, and every country, even the most impoverished country, has a film commission because of the link between having an office that production people can access and the economic development that will come into a jurisdiction. We're, just for background for people who are not, for those representatives who are not familiar with the Film Commission's role, we are, number one, we're the only nonprofit film commission in the country, which means that we receive an appropriation each year from legislators like yourselves, and we thank you for the 30 years that we have been supported by the legislature this year. We have to raise private funds, though, in order to access those state funds. So we're very entrepreneurial. Our main function is to promote Minnesota as a place to do TV commercials, documentaries, feature films, TV series, and more now digital media for the web, but also to provide the ability for business to get done here. So that's everything from information about permitting to how you shoot on the Mississippi River to how do we close a bridge or a road, who do we talk to at the DNR about being in the boundary waters, how do we shoot at the airport on the tarmac. These are all questions that all kinds of producers have, and we are the gateway to the answers for them. We also interface a lot with Department of Labor around child labor laws, and we also and with electrical codes of Minnesota. So we do interface quite a bit with other state agencies and have relationships there. We basically help business get business done much more quickly, and our job is to make it easy to be successful in Minnesota, whether you're coming here for one day to shoot a commercial or for 4 months to make a movie. So that's our job. More and more often now, states are being called upon, state film commissions, to administer incentives. And incentives now really, and this isn't just true for film, it's true for TV series, it's true for commercials. Incentives are the name of the game. Whether it's a tax credit or a rebate, two flavors of incentives, every state that wants to be in the game has some form of incentive. Even states that do not have a business structure and an infrastructure, which we do have here. Minnesota has about a $203 million GDP and in the production industry, and that's about commercials, it's about features, it's about TV series, it's about documentaries, and it's also about 3D production, which goes on here. So we are supporting an existing business, and we want to grow it. Over the last 10 years, it's been in contraction. This brings us to House File 626, which is it's an appropriation of an existing program. This program, which is called the Film Production Jobs Program, it's all about jobs. It's been in existence since 1997. It was funded between 97 and 2002, and again between 2006 and 2011, with results that prove a 7-to-1 ratio of investment, taxpayer investment, to money that comes into the state directly as a result of that investment. The changes to the bill, to the program, are we would be moving administration of our program into DEED from the Department of Administration because it truly is economic development, and we need to be inside that silo. It would also include this would also include independent, if larger films were changing it so that an independent audit would be conducted at the end of production. The biggest, I guess, two impacts would be we are asking for an appropriation of $10 million for the program. And just to put that in perspective for you, the state of Ohio currently has a $40 million
$1 million per year that they have for film production rebates. The state of Pennsylvania has $75 million. So it's $10 million. While it sounds like a lot of money, it gets us back in the game, basically. I think one point that would be helpful for you would just be for those of you who aren't clear about how a rebate works, SnowBate, which is just a brand name we have for the jobs program, is a program in which a producer comes here, is certified by our office, and is given a certification letter. They come here, they do, the economic activity occurs. After it occurs, there's a review of all their financials, and no check is cut by the state of Minnesota until the economic activity has occurred and it's verified. Our work is, of course, checked by our administrating agency, so there's two checks on it. So it's really a no, in terms of the state investing in economic development, it's really economic development that occurs before any investment is paid by the state. So in that way, the biggest thing to remember about production is it's really manufacturing without walls. It's very labor intensive. About 60%, 50 or 60% of our production budget goes to labor. And in our case, the rebate is on Minnesota labor. So you come here, you hire people, you rent equipment, you rent space, you rent parking lots for all the vans that are going to come in, you buy flowers, you buy gasoline, you feed everybody, you put them in hotels, you rent costumes, you buy costumes, all of those things, and they can have very major impacts, especially on smaller Minnesota communities who desperately need the economic activity. This bill favors a greater Minnesota by the highest percentage of the rebate goes to productions that occur outside the metropolitan area. The reason for that is to incent production into greater Minnesota and also to defray some of the costs of moving to a remote area to produce. So with that, I do have several people who work in our industry here who would like to speak to the bill. Sean, you want to come up first?
Come on up. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. Oops, that's a little loud. My name is Sean Otto, and I'm a novelist, writer, author, and filmmaker. I'm the screenwriter and co-producer of the Oscar-nominated movie House of Sand and Fog. I live in Minnesota, and I'm very patriotic about the state, and I'm one of the few filmmakers that I know that are still left here. Many of the people that live here that work in the industry have to work outside of the state in order to find employment. There are a number of screenwriters that I know who wrote movies actually to be shot here. I have one that I'm going to be directing that I've written to shoot here. For instance, Juno, which won the Oscar, was written to be shot here. Wound up shooting in Vancouver because Minnesota was not financially competitive. Gran Torino was written to be shot here. Wound up shooting in Michigan because Minnesota was not financially competitive. These incentives really, Ernst & Young has done a study that shows that they are almost revenue neutral. And if you can imagine that if you do get $7 in direct economic activity back out of an investment, in some tax scenarios, that's fairly close to revenue neutral. So the state's risk is fairly minimal. Right now, we have fallen, as Representative Lesch said, from fourth in the nation behind New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago to 41st in the nation. And the reason that we're 41st is that the other nine states don't have any incentive program whatsoever. And there really is no film production going on there at all. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about my example. Right now, this movie that I've written to shoot here in Minnesota. I'm hoping to shoot it here this summer, but I'm having and I've cast some major movie stars. I have Christine Walker, who is perhaps Minnesota's most accomplished producer, as my partner. I am having a very difficult time convincing our financiers to allow me to shoot it in Minnesota. They want to move it to Louisiana. Because the production incentive there is 30% plus 5% for in-state residents. Minnesota currently is 15%, 20% if we shoot in greater Minnesota. I met with Representative Sertich about the potential of shooting on the Iron Range to try and get some extra IRRRB money. But even with their voting to double their IRRRB money on the spend that happens in the range, we are still about $1 million short on a $7 million movie. That is a very, very big difference if you do the math on that. I'm faced with trying to convince financiers that they should either take a greater risk and perhaps a 12% lower return on their investment, or they say, that $1 million, what do you want to cut out of the movie? Because if you shoot in Louisiana, you can put that up on the screen and you can make that much better of a movie. And as a director, that's really my inclination, is to reinvest in the movie to make it as good as I can make it. So passage of something like Snowbait doesn't affect me personally as far as my my personal economic situation. It just allows me to make a movie where I want to make it, in my home state, with the people that I want to work with, and see the kind of economic activity happen here that supports the industry at a bread and butter level and keeps building it. I have watched it atrophy over the last 10 years to the point where it is very difficult to get any kind of production activity to come from out of state here now. So I would urge your support of that. These types of productions are not artsy-fartsy jobs. They are union jobs. They are construction jobs. They are painters. They are electricians. They are truck drivers. They are caterers. They are hotel owners and hotels. They are small business owners who supply pizzas to all the extras that you hire at the last minute. So it's those that's what really goes into making a movie. A lot of people say that if they had put Hollywood in charge of the disaster in New Orleans, we would have had everybody moved, housed, and fed and clothed in short order, because that's what Hollywood does. So I urge your support, and would be happy to take any other questions if you have them.
Otto and I, do we have another testifier? Perhaps we may bring another testifier up, and then you all would hang around, and we'll see if there's any questions here. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good evening. I'm Brian Simpson. I'm a member of IATSE Local 490, and that is union in town. It's the International Alliance of Theatrical and Studio Employees. We're the ones that make the movies, the crew members, the props, and the makeup and the hair and the wardrobe, and even the special effects. We have people that only make snow. That's their job. They just, that's their trade. That's what they got good at. We even have set medics. These are EMTs who also work in the movie industry. Unfortunately, none of those people I just listed are working in movies in Minnesota at all. And not since 2010. January 2010 was the last time a movie shot in Minnesota that had any kind of a budget that could afford a crew. Everybody else shoots in other states. Nobody shoots in Minnesota. The only thing that happens in Minnesota right now is TV commercials, and that's because there's a lot of ad agencies that are based in Minneapolis. So the movie industry here is getting by on working on TV commercials. Oh, she didn't want me to sell it. Right now I'm working on a Best Buy commercial. On my ride here to come testify for you, I stopped at Padani's Furniture in St. Louis Park and spent $300 renting a desk and a chair. And that's kind of like what we're talking about, like where does the money go with this? Just me, I work in the arts department. I work in set dressing, doing sets, decorating, stuff like that. All of our money, I mean, it's hard to follow just because it goes so many places. It's not just furniture stores, it's lighting stores, it's carpet, flooring stores. It would be, even paint hardware stores. I mean, like everywhere, just trying to recreate a room. If we were doing this room, we would have to find an exit sign to sit there to make it look realistic. We would have to rent all the microphones that you're talking into. The money goes everywhere. Just thinking about movies I've worked on that aren't based here, I worked on a movie called The Crazies, which was kind of a forgettable movie, but it had a $20 million budget, and it was funded and distributed by a company called Sony, and it shot in a town of 1,000 people in Iowa. The town was Lenox, Iowa. We shot there, and we spent $10 million in a town of 1,000 people, well, and then also the neighboring towns, but
businesses stayed open around the clock just in case anybody needed anything. There was a scene where we hired the high school baseball team to come and stage a stage baseball game, and we fixed up their local baseball diamonds that looked like a small town arena, and then they hired the entire town to come down and be extras. So it's like these are movies that don't shoot here, but they could. Oh, yeah. Lucinda's also talking to me. I worked on a movie in Shreveport, Louisiana, another state that has incentives that are much better than here. And this movie was called Butter. It was entirely about, it was a comedy about carving butter at a state fair in the Midwest. Yeah. Nobody carves butter in Louisiana. Nobody had ever even heard that anybody carves butter in Louisiana. And they wanted to film anywhere in the upper Midwest, but nobody in the upper Midwest would offer them an incentive. And just financially, it would be, it's just unwise to even come to Minnesota with a movie right now. Not because you don't want to, and not because a producer, you know, might think that they can make it work. It's just unwise because they can get a better deal in any other state, just as a business. And I'm not talking about, like, you know, for cultural heritage or any sentimental value. In a business sense, it's just completely unwise to come here and film a movie right now. And actually, a lot of commercials are figuring that out now, too, and they are starting to leave to go to places like Illinois. You know, there's this, like, sometimes I think, too, with tax incentives, too, is they get misconstrued, and people think that they're grants. And I just want to say that these are not grants. This is an incentive that comes, like, after you come here and you spend $5, 10, or $15 million, then you turn in all of your receipts, and they're gone, and they go through all the receipts, and they find out which expenses actually qualify for this. So it's after the money comes here. There's this joke that we tell sometimes about how this works, and it goes that Hollywood wants to, you know, comes to Minnesota and says, if I give you $10, will you give me $2.50? And Minnesota says, I can't afford $2.50. And then Hollywood leaves. I mean, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about giving them a grant to do this. They already have the money. It's just about trying to get them to bring their $7.50 here. You know, it's not money that's in Minnesota already. It's money coming from California and coming, or elsewhere, or coming from abroad. Some of the movies I work on have foreign investors. I mean, the money comes from wherever they can get money to make a movie. And it's not necessarily that they don't have the money to make it. Now, companies like Sony and Warner Brothers have the money to make their movie. It's just if they can, in a business sense, go to Louisiana, they should. You know, right now for 490, what's happening to our union is we're shrinking because everybody's leaving to go to Georgia, Louisiana, some go to Michigan. And then another thing that's common right now is people that want to start in this industry. If they get enough experience in commercials, they'll join our union and then immediately transfer to another state because it's easier to get into a foreign state, but another state's union if you're a resident or if you transfer. So that's really kind of the role of the local film industry right now, as a springboard for other states. The big thing also right now is college students ask me all the time. I get emails, I get calls, I see people too. They say, how do I get started in the film industry? And every single college student that asks me that, I tell them, move to Louisiana. Like, you can stay here and maybe get into TV commercials, but it's a very niche community right now. There's just no movies here. It's just the way that it's set up, they're not going to come here. So that's why we're trying to help Lucinda with this bill here.
Very good, very good. Thank you. Questions? Representative Ward was first, I believe, then Representative Hetza, I see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Representative West, you always amaze me with when you do come up with quotes on movies. In a number of committees I sit with you on, and I was just telling Representative Paymar this as we sat on the House floor, I think that guy has watched every movie in the world that I've ever, you know, heard of, and he knows it and he remembers it, and he's got amazing, amazing recall of that. Have you ever heard of Memorial Day? And that's, I'm assuming you folks have had as well. Members, I don't know if you have. It's a Minnesota produced, Minnesota actor, Minnesota everything movie, right? Am I correct on that? And it was, and it's about Memorial Day. It's about Memorial Day, and it's a movie that you all should get and watch. And you can only get it on Amazon, I think, and somewhere else. You know, they were going to offer it over. My understanding is they're going to offer it over in Europe, but they wouldn't do it here in America because none of the big people thought that it could make enough money. But it is one of the best movies I've ever seen with everything, actors, actresses, staging, everything. And so it's a powerful movie, and it shows what can be done in Minnesota. It really, in my opinion. It truly does show what can be done in Minnesota with the filmmaking aspects. And so, but it's also a great story, members. It's also, and those of you that are veterans or military or have a military family, the only reason I saw it is because I sit on the Camp Ripley community citizens group, and they brought us into, the filmmakers brought us in to have a special showing of this down at Camp Ripley. And I went home and I started talking about it. I actually used it in a speech, a Memorial Day speech I gave up in Nisswa, Minnesota, and that American Legion Post bought it and started showing it up in their area as well. So, I mean, it truly is amazing. So it does show. Have you watched it, Representative Lesh? It's unbelievable. So that leads to my question. I'm not just rambling. I have a question. Representative Kiefer has kicked me about 15 times already. I want you to know. So I also sit on Legacy. And Mr. Otto, I know you were over at the Legacy meeting, hearing where we talked about using Legacy dollars to invest in movies in order to make money. I'm assuming this is different. I'm assuming this is very, very different. And so tell us if you can, Snowmate versus Legacy for potential revenue for our state.
Ms. Winter?
Sorry it took me so long to get to that, but I wanted to preference it with, what can be done in Minnesota.
Good question, Mr. Chair and members. The answer is that Legacy, it's complicated. I'll try right now. Since 2011, Snowbait has been funded from Legacy, and our Legacy programs have been funded out of Legacy. The reason we're asking for general fund out, and the reason that was because the legislature did not, by my understanding, the legislature did not want to see Snowbait completely fade to black during the recession that we were coming through. So the bill was written so that our Legacy dollars could be used for Snowbait or Legacy programs. At the advice of the Attorney General, we split it right down the middle. We took the $1 million, we put half in Snowbait, and we put the other half in Legacy programs for Minnesota filmmakers. We narrowed the focus of Snowbait to make it Minnesota-centric so that we would adhere to the Legacy guidelines and principles. Snowbait is a jobs program, and it should be funded with general fund dollars because it truly is economic development. So in a perfect world, what we would have is Snowbait, a jobs creation program, would be funded by general fund dollars, which is the bill before you. And we have also, our office has also put in a request with Legacy for $2 million to fund grants to Minnesota filmmakers who want to tell their stories in film. That would be a production grant, a post-production grant, and a grant directed to new immigrants in Minnesota so that we specifically try to reach out to those folks who have stories to tell to about their Minnesota experience, and also to emerging filmmakers. So in a perfect world, what you would have is Legacy used for what it's intended for, which is to support Minnesota artists who choose to tell their stories through film and digital video. And you would have Snowbait, which would be funded with general fund dollars and truly function as an economic and jobs program. That's the answer to that. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Very, very good sense. And thank you for clarifying that. And I just want to end by saying, where did you say you went down to Iowa to improve those fields and all that stuff?
Been all over. I mean, I have worked in Iowa.
Let me just cut you can come up to Brainerd, and we'll provide a lot of opportunity for you to show as well.
We'd love to. I mean, my wife would love it if I worked in town instead of leaving.
Selfish plug, I'm sorry.
Thank you for that. Selfish plug, Representative Mehta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess Representative Lesh, I love this bill too. Two of my brothers moved out of the state of Minnesota to go work in the film industry out in New York. One's currently a location scout for NBC, and I can attest that when I visit out there, he gets a pile of cash and a credit card, and
days before, but we have to process your application, and you have to get a letter of certification from us before you start, we call it going to camera, start shooting, and before that, the date of that letter on is when you can start being reimbursed for things, for money you spent. The application includes the budget, the script. There's an application form you have to fill out. You also have to provide us with proof from a bank that you have 60% of your funding available and segregated for production. If you're not bonded, many of the larger films have a bond, but if you're not bonded, and we do call the bank and make sure that this is for real. You have to be 60% funded. So there are a number of elements that you, and there are, of course, timelines. So after you complete production, you have so many days to get your materials to us. We have so many days to review your financials. So it's, you know, this is a process. And I should also add, since I have the opportunity, that this program has gone through a legislative audit and had, you know, we got flying colors on the audit. So this program is tried and true. It has been audited. And because we've been able to, you know, we've run this program on a small scale with a small amount of funds, we feel that we have the processes in place, and we've learned and we've improved this program. So now, with a larger amount of funding, we have a program that we feel is pretty rock solid in terms of our capability of making sure the money's properly spent.
Thank you, and we're going to try and keep it succinct here. We've got some other bills, so Representative Leiter.
I'm going to do my best. There's 41 states that do this. We're the only state that has a nonprofit that's kind of in charge of this, that I understand that you've developed the application process independently. I don't know about the oversight on this. My understanding is the 40 other states have a application process that's embedded within their economic development part of government. We have lost potential revenue last 10 years to all these other states. We sit here now asking to go from 20 to 25% now in the production cost for films. That would be their that percentage is and then 20% of the film cost for the films that occur. I mean, only now are we increasing this. My question would be, why aren't we doubling these figures? Because that's the incentive. That's why outside production companies are going to come to this state. It's the rebate that they're looking for. And then, of course, I don't understand the final appropriation of $10 million. To me, that's not even needed, because a real incentive is to get the rebate. I mean, in your own literature, looking at our, you know, the domestic competition, for goodness sakes, look, this is about as clear as can be for any business guy. You raise your incentive so the production companies want to come here, and that's called found money. They're not going to come here unless there's great incentive. And when they come here, I'd much rather take 60% of the piece of the pie rather than, you know, nothing of nothing. Okay, so.
Okay.
Now, part of my other question, how many people are on the board of directors of this nonprofit?
Mr. Chair and members, we can have up to a maximum of 30. Currently, we have 18.
18 members on the board. Mr. Chair, who makes the decision on which production company is going to get those tax credits? Now, I understand we base it on the application process, but who makes the decision that that company qualifies? Is it the board that does it, your board of directors? Is it staff that does this? Could you explain that, please?
Mr. Chair and members, this is a program that it's not a tax credit, it's a rebate. So production incentives come in two flavors: tax credits, which are tied to your corporate tax year, and the credit is reported at the end of the corporate tax year in which you make the production and is tied to your corporate taxes. We do not run through the Department of Revenue here, but all of our then we go through the assessment process. If you do not meet the criterion, you will not be approved. All of our decisions are subject to review by our administrating agency. So until we went into Legacy, that was the Department of Tourism. So everything we did was double-checked by tourism. Now we're in this bill, the call is for us to move for administration into deed, in which case we will have an administrator to whom we report. And so even though we're a nonprofit, we are certainly a state agency subject to all the, we have a private audit every year, we have legislative audits on a scheduled basis. So I don't think that's an issue, because everything that we do and all the checks that we request requisition are checked by a state agency.
Thank you. You covered the answer on that one.
Right.
Thank you. And I was just told the appropriation is for the tax, rebate. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, this rebate doesn't have anything to do with taxes other than the fact that when people come, when production companies come here and spend money, everybody's paying income taxes and sales tax. But this is not a tax credit. This is a reimbursement of expenses called, in the vernacular of the production world, it's called a rebate.
Thank you, Ms.
Okay, well, that explains it a little bit better. What do the other states do? The 40 other ones that are beating the South.
Mr. Leidinger, this might be the prettiest map I've ever seen in the community. You've got to look at it. It's all multicolored.
Right.
Representation.
You know, I don't mean...
It's about half.
I'm sorry. I didn't look at the back of that.
Mr. Chair, members, just so everyone knows, this is a really great reference, and it's very current. It's January 2013, and it indicates which states have rebates. There's about 14. Which ones have tax credits, and then tax credits come in three flavors, refundable, transferable, and non-refundable, which is nobody likes, and only California is non-refundable. So we have a rebate, and the reason we do is because this program was designed as a rebate in 1997, and it has worked for our state, and so we are, you know, that's... Yes.
Well, Mr. Ron, we're trying to wrap this up here. We got some other bills, so
okay.
Please be...
I'll be brief, Mr. Chair, Representative Leidinger. I just wanted to say from a production perspective that a rebate is actually more effective than a tax credit. Tax credits are generally sold at 85 cents on the dollar. So a rebate at 25% is really as effective as a tax credit at about 32%. So Minnesota's ask would place it at a competitive standing with almost every other state.
Thank you, Representative Leidinger. Got a couple other people, Representative Leidinger, so ready to move on. Thank you. Representative Ugham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Winter, I guess, that was going to be really my question. What's more effective, a rebate or tax credit? I see there's transferable tax credits and so on and so forth. Now, from a production company standpoint, having that rebate, much simpler program, upfront money, pretty quick reimbursement and everything else, that is an advantage for our state, even though we're at a lower level in some cases, isn't it?
Okay. Ms. Winter.
Mr. Chair, members, to some extent, it depends on who you talk to. For us, this is a very clean program. For filmmakers, as Sean just indicated, there's no net loss of a company comes here, an individual can apply. A company comes here, does the economic activity. We have gateways for how long everybody has to process everything, and so a check comes out at the other end much more quickly than a tax credit would. That is true. This is also a tried and true. We know this program works. We have plenty of data on how many FTEs we've created, what our cost per job is. We know all of those things. There's always discussion of whether you should switch to a tax credit but there's a fiscal note on a tax credit too. So here the challenge is the money has to be appropriated from the state budget, whereas a tax credit, some states have gone to tax credits that they spread out over 3 years, so their fiscal note, it bumps down their fiscal note. If The kinds of films that we are likely to attract with this level of funding, which would be films in the $5, $10, $50 million range, as Sean has said, it's attractive to them because it's simple to understand, it's simple to process, and it also allows them a reimbursement after production and to encourage them to do their post-production work here. They can do a second one after post because this is for your whole production budget. We are then helping them with some of the costs of post-production by allowing them to receive a check after production and before post, which is attractive to smaller productions. It's a cash flow issue.
Yep. Very good. Thank you. That answers my question. Thank you.
Okay. All right. We're going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion, and thank you all very much.
Thank you, members.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead, Representative Lash. I was speaking with
some of the talent scouts in the back of the room before we came up, and they were mentioning, murmuring to each other that you have a face for movies, and they want to include you in, so as well as Representative Mahoney. So there may be a future for
you. And you're figuring that's going to get you some help on your bill, eh? Well, thank you for saying it. Thank you for being here. Okay, next up on the docket is 1046, the Mahoney bill. We'll move this bill for to lay over for possible inclusion.
And that lake in hell is starting to get a little hard, easier to walk on. The chamber, please join me at the table.
movie might look like. It's a one-page thing that they do by different regions. But that's kind of a snapshot of the simplicity that we might be looking at with a supply and demand report like this.
Very good. Representative Mahoney.
Chair, committee members, this is not the perfect bill at the present time. We have to have conversations with the Senate and with Dean. We're trying to work with them to lessen the fiscal note, and I'm going to ask if Mr. Soderberg has any comments on the fiscal note, other than it's large.
Mr. Chairman and members, yes, the chairman's right. The fiscal note is written in the Senate file. Section 1 of the fiscal note, if you look at page 2, is written in the House file. A lot of the cost is related to, I'm talking about the deed section on page 2, you'll see section 1. And those costs are shown on page 3. It's about $873,000 is what we're estimating for the house.
Thank you, Mr. Soderberg.
I expect to spend that kind of money.
Yeah, sure.
You had a question?
Yeah, I just
have a note
on the bill as well. And usually, you know, I'm a fiscal conservative. Everybody knows that. I usually say, does this have a fiscal note? At the time, it really wasn't. I think it's a good idea, and I want to just explain even more that, you know, we hear so much. Kids are coming out of college, and they can't find a job. Well, that's because there's this mismatch. So I think this is really a great idea, but I agree we need to work more on reducing the cost. So sorry I have to go to another committee.
Sure. You're voting an absentee for this, right? start with a base, and they do make projections as to where the jobs are going. What are the jobs of tomorrow you're going to be? That comes out a lot out of the statistical analysis done at Deed and their labor statistics. I might be having the name of the department wrong. But that's where a lot of this data, much of this data will come. It's to where those top 10 or 110 jobs are, or what they are, and where they are. Any system perfect? No. But that's where we're going to try to get, so that somebody taking this class down at Marshall kind of understands, or is out of a job in Marshall, knows what classes to take at Marshall, the university down at Marshall, if they want to stay in the area. Or they could go to the Itasca Junior College or wherever. Whatever their particular field would be. So it could be financial analyst. There's going to be a ton of them because there's all these gray-haired people retiring, or pipe fitters, because all of them are retiring. And this is the credentials that you need. That's what this is envisioned to be.
Representative Lomart.
I just have one follow-up then. Well, just as a piggyback then, can the Itasca project and Deed and this legislation combine or meld in an effort to reduce the fiscal load?
Representative Mahoney.
I think there are many ways to reduce this fiscal note. Some of them that way, some of them negotiating with Deed, some of them going over what Deed has said is a cost here. I've already identified a few that I'll be having a deeper conversation with before this would be put into the bill. We'd have a clearer understanding of who's paying for what and how much it costs.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember there was another organization in Minnesota, and it was under this committee, and I can't remember the name of it, but they came up with the top 10 jobs to get into in Minnesota, and it was such a controversial list that this is very refreshing looking what they said. At the time, one of their jobs they thought would be a good one to go for was working in the Iron Range. And unfortunately, the Iron Range is going down real fast at the time. And I think they almost took a dartboard and threw darts at jobs and picked those because it was really, really off. So this is very much more scientific and very much more useful.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Mahoney will renew the motion to lay over House Call 1046 for possible inclusion, and we'll move on to House Call 1137. Please, Representative Mahoney, and thank you, Ms. Walskin. Representative Mahoney, a couple of amendments on that 1137A. Like one is a DE and maybe an A2 here. Very good, Representative Mahoney. This will lay 1137 on the table temporarily.
Six, seven, eight. This is a... President Hellstrom, the House File 678, if you would bring it up, I would like to bring it up. Would you move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I'm not on your committee. I would love to.
No,
move the bill.
I will move 678.
And 678.
678, isn't it? That's your bill. And members, this is the one that we've spoken about a couple times tonight. Thank you, Representative Hellstrom.
Chair, members, you've seen this bill already. You've voted on it in the past. It's a remarkable bill. So all I'm doing, all we are doing here is moving this bill from this committee over to the capital investment. It is a bonding bill. It's a bonding request, $150,000 bonding request for elevator in our civic center in Brainerd for handicap accessibility of our building. That's what, if you remember the bill, and I think everybody here except probably Representative Albright voted for it. But anyhow, members, that's the gist of the bill, and I would move that this bill be passed. As presented and moved to capital investment.
Okay. Any questions from members? No questions. So all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion passed by a whisker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
decision that they are applying for shared work. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, do you have a fiscal note on this bill?
Representative Mahoney. Confident that we can represent Fabian.
The copy that I have, Mr. Chair members, Mr. Soderberg, the copy that I have is to the bill, another bill that was introduced that includes this language, but we did have signed on earlier today on this.
This one is written to the original bill.
Yeah.
There's only additional room.
of members. At the peak of the recession, the shared work program affected about 17,000 people. It was about $12 to $13 million from the UI Trust Fund. Now it ranges, it's in the thousands, in a couple thousands, and it's between $2 and $3 million that from the trust fund that suspended on this.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. I think Representative Gunther made reference to a positive cash balance in the UI Trust.
That's correct.
And is that the fruit of the program way from before this? I'm not trying to be belligerent. I'm just trying to understand where this money is coming from, because it sounds like you've got some money, but then other states don't have money. And I'm trying to understand, is it because we manage it better than other states, or is it because... I'm trying to put my arm around
it. Jim Mahoney.
The UI Trust Fund is money taken out of everyone's paycheck every week or every month or whatever it is. And it is actually held in trust in Washington, D.C. In 2008 or 2009, whenever the depths of the recession hit, we started with $700 or $800 million in our trust fund, lasted 3-6 months, whatever it was, maybe even 8 or 9. We went into a deficit approaching $2 billion. Our trust fund went into a deficit approaching $2 billion. Minnesota's trust fund. I can't even calculate the number that the national trust fund would be as a total. Because we've climbed out of our recession faster and with greater zeal than other states, we have a whole slew of, is it a page and a half of added levers, I guess they call them, yeah, thank you, that get thrown on to the unemployment cost of an employer. Ours went up relatively quickly, and that's one of the reasons we have a $305 million reduction coming in. Our levers went up very high. We collected a tremendous amount of money, and we've been in the black for, I don't know,
line. So we're on the max of 14% on what? 14% of what?
That's a great question. Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and I will get back to you.
That's fine. That's fine. Representative Bateman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Bateman, the base rate, is that, you talked about, is that the same for everybody, or is it flexible by the industry that you're in, because some industries have higher rates, naturally have higher rates of unemployment?
Representative Mahoney.
Thanks very much.
Over for possible inclusion. As amended. Thank you. Thank you all.